Okay, folks, welcome again. This is Elvin Shamroth, and welcome to our teleconference. We have already lost, so to speak, 50% of our candidates because two of the four exam week periods have gone by. And I want to tell you folks listening in, we do not pump candidates for questions they were asked in the exam. ABOG doesn't want you to share any information with anyone in this regard, and we don't ask you folks about that. But what I can tell you is I spoke with a candidate who I had worked with rather extensively throughout the year, and the message that he shared with me was this: the material that we have been pushing and promoting as being exam relevant was very much the case. It was all exam relevant. And I mention that to you folks because I would suspect that every single one of you listening in has spent some time with us at ExamPro. Virtually all of you have come to our Definitive Board Prep course where we shared all this material with you. And I share this with you now to give you a feeling of confidence that, I mean, I can't guarantee what ExamPro will ask any individual candidate, but overall, I think the generalization holds true, that the material that we feel is exam relevant is, in fact, exam relevant, and if you've been working with us throughout the year, I think you should feel well prepared, and you should feel good about that. That being said, we do not have any candidates who has submitted a case or any concern that they may have. So I don't have any candidates on the hot seat today. But what I am going to do is, as I've done on occasion in the past, I'm going to open up, I'm going to unlock the teleconference. Again, I'm going to ask you all, please make sure that you're in a room where there's no background noise, because it does become problematic for all of us. So please ensure that that's the case, number one. Number two, I'm going to ask in a moment if you can just call out your first name if you have a question, no matter how simple or difficult it might be. Just call out your first name, I'll acknowledge, and then we can have a conversation. So what I'm going to first do is unmute everyone. Bear with me one second. There we go. Okay, good, and we have relative quiet, so thank you so much, everyone. This is the time. If you've got a question, please shout out your first name, and I'll acknowledge, and then we can discuss whatever your question or concern might be. So go ahead. Anyone want to shout out their first name? Come on, folks. If no one volunteers, this is going to be a very, very, very short teleseminar. So I'm sure you folks all have questions. Don't be shy. Come on, folks. We need someone out there who wants to shout out a first name. I'll acknowledge and we can discuss it, whatever your concern might be. Go
Victoria.
Ahead, folks. Victoria, thank you so much for volunteering. Yes, I hear you loud and clear. Thank you. Go ahead and share with us what your question, your concern, your case is.
Thank you, Dr.
Shamroth.
Sure.
I have on my GYN list where I ended up doing a LSO on an 18-year-old for a 9-centimeter multiloculated cystic mass. And I'm and I'm worried about being asked why I did an LSO on an 18-year-old. Ideally, I would prefer to do a cystectomy, but it wasn't.
It's a great question, and it brings up an issue which is very important for everyone listening in, and I'll develop the theme in just a moment. But in essence, you've got two potential questions. Are you concerned about doing an oophorectomy in an 18-year-old as opposed to a cystectomy? And or are you concerned about removing the tube at the same time?
Both.
Okay, fine, because they're two separate issues. So let me go in reverse, basically. The basic principle that I want all of you folks listening in to remember is this. Between you and the two examiners in that GYN exam room, you are the only one that, in this case, saw the pelvis of an 18-year-old with a 9-centimeter mass. Some of you may have other findings. What the circumstance is somewhat irrelevant to the conversation. But you're the only one who actually saw it. So they can't argue with you as you describe what you saw. Now, I'm not for a second suggesting you should be dishonest and lie about what you found, but by all means, be honest, and if there's any room for a gray zone, use it to your advantage. And with that background, that's the basic principle. With that background, I would answer in the following fashion. You, Victoria, correctly said you're worried, you feel bad about removing an 18-year-old's ovary. So I would take the bull by the horns and bring this right up front into my conversation. When they ask me if I'm just going to role play your situation, I would say this was a very unfortunate case, because you will notice I had to remove an ovary in an 18-year-old. This is tragic. I try to avoid this wherever possible. But in this particular case, there were extenuating circumstances. That's the overall introductory line of thought. So, excuse me, you're immediately telling your examiner, I don't do this kind of thing willy-nilly. This was an exceptional case. So you open up in that way, and then you go on to say, there were extraordinary circumstances in this case. When I isolated the ovary, the anatomy, and just coming to my overriding point, they can't argue with you on anatomy. You said, as I looked at this at Nexa, the mass was of such a size, and no one's going to argue with you that a 9-centimeter cyst is a significant size. The mass was of such a size, and the anatomy was such that if I were to have removed the cyst and done a cystectomy, assuming that would have been possible, and given the anatomy, I'm not sure that was possible, but there would have been no viable ovarian tissue left. The ovarian blood supply would have been so compromised, it would not have left any viable ovarian tissue left. So what I did was I checked the contralateral ovary. It was fine. It was not a problem. It was healthy. And I went ahead and did an oophorectomy. I would have preferred to have done just an oophorectomy and left the tube alone. But once again, the anatomy was such that had I removed the ovary on its own, the tube itself would have been sorely compromised. And so I felt the best thing to do for this patient was to do a unilateral salpingo-oophorectomy. And that's what I did. So as you hear me say that, Victoria, how does it sound to your ear?
Sounds very reasonable. It sounds like that I was making those decisions intraoperatively with what I was doing.
Yeah, and you're showing the examiner, you're always, wherever possible, wherever there's an opportunity, you're trying to be as conservative as possible. And that's the bottom line here. That's what the examiner wants to see. And ironically, the fact that you've done an LSNO on an 18-year-old, if you're well prepared, which you will be now, it actually sets you up beautifully to share with the examiner that you are, in fact, ultra-conservative. So you can use a case like this to counterintuitively create the exact opposite of impression of what it might appear like superficially. So, Victoria, would you be comfortable with this?
Yes. And I also was wondering if it would be helpful to mention the pre-op counseling method.
I didn't quite hear. Would it be helpful to mention the pre-op what?
Counseling.
Pre-op counseling, listen. This, I'm so pleased you asked that question. It's actually a very important question. Any folks, this is to each and every one of you, mostly GYN, but also OB, and also to a significant extent office. Any treatment that you meet out, especially surgery, you must be prepared to describe how you counsel the patient. And when you get into a conversation of counseling, it's risks, benefits, and alternatives. Just get it as a mantra into your system. Risks, benefits, alternatives. Because in discussing risks, benefits, alternatives, you actually, in effect, show the examiner your understanding of the disease pathology that you're being presented with. So, yeah, preoperative counseling is always very important. So, Victoria, are you comfortable with that then?
Yes, I'm feeling much better.
Good. It's actually a great case because it sets you up beautifully to have a conversation in which you can shine. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you.
All right. Do you have any other cases or questions that you're concerned about?
I had a small question.
Yeah.
I had a patient with abnormal uterine bleeding with a BMI of 69, and part of my initial workup was to do an endometrial biopsy.
Sorry, can I interrupt for a second? Did you say AUB or PMB?
AUB.
Okay, go ahead. AUB, morbidly obese, yeah.
AUB, BMI of 69. I was unable to obtain an office biopsy just due to patient intolerance for pain. So I took her to the OR for a hysteroscopy DNC, but the final pathology came back benign, which is fortunate for the patient. But I'm wondering if they'll ask, like, you know, and I'm prepared to answer it. Like, are you surprised by this? Like, in a BMI of 69, would you have expected to find something else? Or is it okay? I mean, I can't change the pathology. It was benign.
So look, your question is totally appropriate. And if I was the examiner in the room with you, I would ask that exact question. And you can say, yes, in a morbidly obese patient, there's always a concern for peripheral conversion of estrogen in the fatty tissue, and that predisposes to EIN and cancer. So while I won't go so far as to say I was surprised that it came back benign. I would say she was at an increased risk of it not having come back benign. How does that sound to you?
Yes, that's what happened.
And so the bigger question here, and folks, just by the way, it's really important that all of you, it's really a favorite topic, this exam topic, this discussion of ruling out EIN and endometrial cancer. You got to know the workup and the management and the counseling. I just want you to know it's really important, okay? But the, in addition to what we've discussed, what's maybe more important, you've got to be able to describe what would you do subsequently for this patient. How old was she, by the way? I never got that. Victoria? Just ballpark. How old was she?
She was, I think, 49 or 50.
Okay, so that's up there. The question is that much more relevant. How do you follow up on this patient? Would you do 6, 12, 24 monthly hysteroscopies, DNCs? What are the pros and cons of and various sensitivities of an endometrial biopsy in the office versus a hysteroscopy versus a DNC versus a transvaginal ultrasound in the evaluation of AUB versus postmenopausal bleeding? That's where the conversation will go. And Victoria, certainly in this case, you need to be comfortable to handle that conversation. And for all of you listening in, I would say it's important as well that you need to be comfortable with this AUB, PMB, EIN conversation. It's a favorite, okay? So just be ready for that. And obviously, in terms of management, discuss what your options are. If she continued to bleed, would you give her progesterone? How much? How would you give it to her? That's where the conversation would go. So are you comfortable with that, Victoria?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, perfect. Before we go to anyone else, Victoria, do you have another question or is that it?
That's it for now. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you so much. All right, folks, I'm going to open it up to anyone else. If you want to just shout out your first name, I'll acknowledge and then we can chat. So come on, folks. Yes.
Hello.
Who's that? Yes.
This is Ariane.
I didn't get your name. Say again. Sorry.
Ariane.
Marianne.
Yeah, with the A.
Okay, Marianne. Thank you so much for volunteering. Go ahead and share with us your concern.
Yes. On my OB case list, I have a 37-year-old G3P2, was 39 weeks and scheduled, it was a scheduled repeat C-section. Her OB history, she had a history of Graves' disease. She was status post-thyroidectomy and she was controlled on Synthroid. The C-section went as planned, as the normal C-section, normal MST on admission and normal fetal heart rate right before the spinal. However, when the baby was delivered, it was limp. The APSARs were 2, 7, 7, 7, 8, essentially. The cord gases.
Hold on. You just gave us five APGARs. So I'm going to assume that you went out for 25 minutes or 20 minutes. You went at 1, 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes. You did APGARs. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. 2, 7.
But you
said
it was 1, 5, 7, 7, 8. Yes?
Oh, 2, 2, 7, 7, 7, 8.
Okay. So I'm interrupting you and we'll get to your point. I'm so pleased you brought this up, because I'm going to critique you. Your 1 minute was two. I understand. That's concerning. But we're not that worried about a one-minute APGAR. Your five-minute APGAR was seven. So if you get a five-minute APGAR of seven, why was it necessary to do the APGAR again at 10, 15, and 20 minutes? It's overkill is what I'm getting at. So can you explain that?
Yes, the neonate was very limp and hypotonic at birth, so there and was requiring resuscitation. So,
but you did have a 5 minute APGAR at seven, which tells me this baby couldn't have been that limp at 5 minutes. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think I've got the answer for you. Please correct me if I'm wrong. I would defend this by saying, that was my thinking too. Once you've got an APGAR of greater than five, I think it is, at 5 minutes, you don't need to continue doing APGARs every 5 minutes. But this is what the pediatrician did, but I'm not convinced that it was absolutely required. How does that sound to you? And I might be wrong, but tell me, you put me right.
I agree, but yes, that's good.
Okay, so folks, the point that I want to make with this last comment is just as you don't want to leave something out in terms of a workup or a therapy, etc. You don't want to do too much either, because it could be construed as not being confident in what you're doing. It could be construed as overutilization of resources. You've got to do whatever you decide to do. You've got to have a reason.
Yeah.
And I'd have no problem with Marianne presenting this way, but I think you've got to add, even though the 5 minute APGAR was seven, I don't think it was necessary to continue measuring APGARs beyond that point. But they did, and it went 7, 7, 8 or whatever it was. Okay? All right, so that's a side issue. Marianne, let's come back to the concern. We've got this C-section, 39 weeks, Graves on Synthroid, baby was doing fine, delivered the baby and was flat at least in the first minute or two or three. Carry on.
Yeah, the baby was resuscitated with CPAP, and her cord gases that were obtained showed a pH of 6.8 and a deficit of 3. Overall,
plus or minus 3. Base deficit of?
Minus 23.
Whoa, okay. So it's been a lot. Let me just help me out here. I'm not an MFM. I'm a generalist. Your base of minus 23 sounds very acidotic to me. Am I correct?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
And the venous gas was quite close to that point, indicating placental.
And the placenta what? I didn't hear that.
Oh, sorry. The venous cord gas was a similar pH, indicating a placental metabolism issue. Ultimately, the baby was diagnosed with moderate HIE and underwent active cooling.
Did you say moderate HIV? I didn't quite hear that. Moderate what?
Correct.
The baby was diagnosed with HIV.
Hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy.
Oh, okay. Okay, fine. Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay. Are you done, or there's still more?
That's it. The baby did have some syndromic features. She had a hypoplastic thumb and some ulnar wrist deviation. So she did undergo genetic testing, which was negative. But yeah, that's essentially
back. Okay, so this is again an interesting case, and it comes with a warning to all of you. Marianne, you want as much as you possibly can to avoid, and this goes to all of you listening in, you want to avoid a conversation on cord gases and what represents metabolic versus respiratory acidosis or alkalosis. You know, you don't want to get in a conversation on the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. You're not going to be comfortable with that. So I especially since the APGARs were reasonable, did you put down on the paper the 10, 15, and 20-minute APGARs? Did you put that down on paper?
No.
Good. Because there wasn't. So you don't even have to mention that issue that I was making, because it's not down on paper. Mm-hmm. No one needs to know. So I would start try and shy away from all of this, and I would just say, When this baby was born, there was evidence of an acidosis. The pH was 6.8, and I would leave it at that. If they ask you more and dig out of you more issues about cord gases, fine, you'll give the best you can do. But don't volunteer to get yourself into a difficult conversation, because it's not the kind of conversation that we as generalists generally groove on, and I'm sure you'd agree with that. So minimize the detail of the acidosis. And you can even, if you want it, you cannot mention it at all, because the APGARs were actually reasonable. So you shouldn't feel obligated, but I'm not going to tell you don't mention it. I'm just going to say minimize it if you're going to mention it at all. That's number one. Number two, notice how I'm dissecting out this case with Marianne, because my response will depend on what she has written down, what the examiner sees, because they're going to ask questions based on what they see. The examiner will not, for example, see a 10, 15, and 20-minute gap call, so you don't need to mention it. My question coming back to you, Marianne, my question is, did you mention on paper the fact that there were some congenital anomalies?
No, I didn't.
So there again, if you want to mention it, you can, but you don't have to. And as a generalization, again, we don't generally groove on a discussion on genetics and congenital anomalies. So if this comes up, mention it. They're not going to probe you to any great extent, but again, I would minimize the conversation rather than voluntarily get into a deep conversation. Just generally minimize it. Does that sound reasonable to you? And you can say, by the way, this baby subsequently was noted to have some minor congenital anomalies, which was, you can mention HIE. But again, just minimize the conversation. Are you comfortable with that, Marianne?
Yes, that's great. So kind of, I mean, essentially I'll present the information that's on my list and kind of for them to ask me more.
Yeah, let them dig it out of you. and you'll give it the best you can, rather than you volunteer it and give yourself a difficult time. You understand?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Very nice. I'm pleased you asked that, Casey. Any other questions on your end, Marianne?
Well, the baby was IUGR. The weight was 2385. Do you think I should? I mean, that's pretty obvious, and that's probably what caused the issue. That the what I believe happened was the patient was very petite. She got her spinal. She was hypotensive, and she had essentially undetected IUGR, and the baby was likely, you know, bradycardic.
I think personally, it's very nice to say in the exam, after the fact, you say, you know, in retrospect, I noticed when I saw the baby's weight of 2,300 grams at 39 weeks, I realized in retrospect, this was a case of IUGR which had been missed on ultrasound. And that's okay. Ultrasound is not very accurate. But if you say that, be prepared for a discussion on two things. Number one, how accurate is ultrasound when it comes to estimation of fetal weight? And it's roughly plus or minus 20%, some say 10%. But it's not very accurate. And there's another question is, they would ask you about, okay, had you have diagnosed it at the time, IUGR, how would you have managed her? And then that becomes a conversation on antenatal testing, prenatal testing, fetal testing. Okay? So it's really a straightforward case, this particular one. I would encourage you, whereas I discourage the genetics, I discourage the cord gas, I encourage the conversation on IUGR, because that's one you could handle very comfortably, I assume.
Okay. So they asked me to describe the case, and I could kind of, at the end of the presentation, mention that in retrospect.
Yeah, and you say in retrospect, I noticed this was a case of IUGR, which was missed.
Mm-hmm.
And you're setting yourself up for a conversation on IUGR when you say that.
Great.
Okay.
Sure,
my pleasure. Any other questions on your end, or are you done?
Not for that case, but if you don't have anyone else, I have like one.
Okay,
one
so let me just see if there's anyone else, and if not, we'll come back to you. I'm throwing it open to everyone. Anyone else there want to shout out their first name? And I'll acknowledge anyone.
Jennifer.
Come on, folks. Jennifer, thank you so much for volunteering. Go ahead. Share with us your concern.
I have a couple questions. One is really quick. I noted on my OB case list that I have an incorrect fetal weight that would make it undiagnosed growth restriction, but the baby was not growth restricted. Should I, as soon as they walk into the room for OB, say, just so you know, I have a, like, an error?
No, don't do that. Don't say, hi, I'm Dr. So-and-so, there's an error on case number 16. No, do not do that. If, let's say it's case number 16, if they ask you, please present case number 16, then say, can I just, I'm happy to do this, just let me share with you, there is a typographic error on this case. This baby weighed X rather than Y, but I'm happy to discuss any aspect of this case. And then leave it at them. And be able to, your question is, for you, is exactly the same as what I just shared with Marianne. Okay? How accurate is ultrasound, and how do you manage IUGR?
Okay. So just, okay, because right. It looks like it's a very, like, growth rate. It's like, it has 1,800 grams and it was 2,800. So if they say,
okay, so that's substantial.
Fetal growth
restriction, then. Okay. All the issues that I mentioned previously are relevant for you, too. But you said you had a second question or another case. Go ahead.
Yes. On my GYN case list, I have a patient who had a history of an ablation and what basically was an aborted hysteroscopy because I couldn't get into the cavity. She ultimately opted to not do anything.
I need to interrupt you. This was a case of a hysteroscopy followed by an ablation. Am I correct?
No, sorry. She had a history of an ablation and presented with AUB.
Okay, I misunderstood that. Sorry. Okay, I'm with you now. Go ahead.
So she had inadequate in-office sampling, so I took her for a hysteroscopy, but I aborted the procedure because I couldn't get into the cavity. And she had no other risk factors and declined anything further like a hysterectomy, so she opted just for observation. Is that...
Let me pause you for a second. I've got to ask you a couple of questions. Number one, how old was she? Was she obese? Did she have risk factors for endometrial hyperplasia?
She was 42 and had no risk factors. She was thin.
Okay. And she had AUB, and was it bothersome to her?
It initially was very sporadic, but then by the time I saw her in follow-up, she was basically having like a monthly cycle that was not very heavy, so no.
And so you had a patient who had abnormal uterine bleeding, seems to be normalizing spontaneously. Excuse me. you try and do a hysteroscopy, fails because of the prior ablation. Do you think in that? Sorry. Okay, maybe that was someone else. Do you think it's appropriate to offer such a patient, as we've described, hysterectomy at this point?
I did offer it as an ultimate option if the bleeding was bothersome, since we could not further like evaluate it. But I did not recommend that it needed to be done.
So let me dissect it out with you. Let's say she continued to have abnormal uterine bleeding, but she was okay with it. So she's not complaining of it, but she's having irregular bleeding. Would you offer her a hysterectomy in that situation?
Yes, if it was not cyclic bleeding. If I didn't think it was a failed ablation and I was worried there was something else.
So that's exactly the point I'm driving at. Actually, it's a little aggressive, but I'm quite comfortable with the answer. But you've got to emphasize something. And this point, again, all of you might find yourself in this kind of conversation. When I said she's bleeding, but it's not bothering her, I'm basically making a distinction between if you're going to do hysterectomy, are you doing it for therapeutic purposes? And the answer would be no. Then why are you doing it? You're doing it for diagnostic purposes. And to do a diagnostic hysterectomy sounds very aggressive, and it is. But sometimes it may be an appropriate way to go. If you've tried everything else and there's a legitimate concern for hyperplasia or malignancy, then it's a legitimate option. So I want you to be, all of you, to be comfortable to have this conversation and be comfortable to distinguish between what might prompt you to offer a diagnostic versus a therapeutic hysterectomy. Okay? 99% of the time it's therapeutic. But in this case, it might have been diagnostic. Is that the point you're making, Jennifer?
Yes.
Okay, good. So did I answer your question in all of that, or is there still another question that you've got for me in this case?
No, you answered it. Thank you.
All right, excellent, good. That was Jennifer, yes? Was that you?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good, sure. There was someone that had another case. I said we'll come back to it. Who was that? Who had another case?
Oh.
No one.
Yes.
Who's that? What's the name? Is that Marianne?
Yeah, but that if someone else has something, feel free.
Okay, we'll open it up one more time to anyone else. Anyone with a question? Going once? Going twice?
Erin?
Marianne, you're on. Oh, go ahead. Yo, who is that?
This is Erin.
Erin, hi. Thank you so much. Go ahead. What's your question?
Thank you. So I have a patient on my obstetric case list who was a G1 who had an uncomplicated C-section initially for arrestive descent, but she developed refractory atony within about 3 hours after her C-section. She had a JADA and failed that and full spectrum of uterotonics. So we took her back to the OR and opened her up, and I guess I had some help with the case. There's a chief resident, and then it was like my second call shift, so another attending was there, and I feel like I think I mostly just feel uncomfortable talking about it because I feel like the C-HIST we ultimately did was maybe a little aggressive, and we mostly did it based on anesthesia's discomfort with the patient's vitals, but like the patient wasn't actively bleeding a ton. But I think I know the answer to the question, which is like, you know, just because I'm uncomfortable with it, I don't have to like try to get out too many extra details and just say like, you know, what we did and what would be indicated at different times. But I just wanted to kind of hear a little bit about what you think about that.
Sure. Again, a very nice case. Number one, you emphasize that this was an unstable patient. I would not mention it was the second time you were on call. I would not mention that in the exam. But you say that this patient became unstable as measured by ABC, and I felt it was absolutely warranted to go back and look. The uterotonics, this ABXYZ was not working, and I had to go back. When I went in, I went in with another colleague of mine, and we both felt that the best thing for this patient, as young as she was, I can't recall the age, and as low as her parity was, the safest thing to do was to do a hysterectomy. And I had to concern myself. The clinical situation was such that I had to be more concerned with saving the patient's life than saving her uterus. And let me ask you this question. If you, and be honest with us now, if you were given the same patient under the exact same circumstances tomorrow, would you roughly speaking manage her the same way?
Yeah, I think
there's the
I
answer. No, but you just gave the right answer. And folks, no, virtually all of us have bad outcomes. Fortunately, not too many, but we have the occasional one. This is a good outcome. You saved the patient's life, but she lost her uterus. But it's a good outcome. Be comfortable to acknowledge that and say, you know, I had to concern myself with saving her life. And you furthermore go on to say, you know, and you use this exact language if you want. I've thought about this case so much since having managed the patient. And I've come to the realization, if I were presented with exactly the same situation again tomorrow, I would do exactly the same thing. Because when you say that, it's a very powerful statement that you've got the conviction that your management was correct. And you are just upset that you had to remove a uterus in a relatively young patient. And that just means you've got a heart and that you feel for your patients. It's all good. You're not God. You can't save every uterus. You can't save every patient. So, yeah, we feel bad. And it's to our credit that we feel bad. And be comfortable to share it with the examiner. Because you come off as being one who is caring, who's concerned for the well-being of your patients. So don't be blasé and go, I just whipped out the uterus. It was the easiest thing to do. I had a game of golf. You know, that's not the way to go, obviously. But show a sense of caring and sensitivity, absolutely. I'd have no problem. And again, this is another case where you have a situation where an unfortunate outcome, I wouldn't call this unfortunate. I think it's really fortunate because you saved the life. But a arguably unfortunate outcome is actually a setup for you to shine in the exam, as long as you're comfortable to present it that way. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. Thank you very much.
All right, sure. It's a great case. Know it well. Be comfortable to talk about it.
Okay.
All right. folks, we're out of time. I know the exam is in, the last exams are in 2 and 4 weeks' time. If any of you are still interested in coming to our finishing touches course down in Dallas, it's designed to be taken the day before the exam. Get in touch with our office because there are, I think it's 8 people per session. I can't remember call it. It's a limited number. But just get in touch with the office if you're interested. And the last thing I will share with you is just know your cases well and practice talking. You know, you've got 2-4 weeks to go. It's more than enough time to do virtually anything you need to do. Just have mock oral sessions with friends, with colleagues, with us, with whoever. Just be comfortable to talk about your cases. That's the key thing. And lastly, the next this teleseminar is 1 week later than we should have done it. I was unavailable. I apologize last week, but because we're 1 week late, the next teleseminar will only be in 1 week's time, not in 2 weeks' time. So our next teleseminar will be in 1 week. I guess it's the second or fourth. 3rd, 4th of October, and that will be our last teleseminar for the year. So we're almost at the end. I'm going to ask you folks, please share with us your results when you get them. My faculty, my staff, myself, we really appreciate hearing from you, and we know historically our pass rate's about 98-97%. So we feel pretty good about that. And I share that with you because you should feel good too if you've come up through the exam pro system, which I'm guessing every single one of you have done so. So for next week, if any of you have any cases you want to submit, please feel free to do so. So we don't have to do this open season like we did this time. But for those who did volunteer, thank you so much. It did make it that much more interesting. And all the questions, all the cases, by the way, were really very, very good and very highly exam relevant. So, folks, thank you so much. We'll do this again this time next week. Thank you so much. This then concludes our teleconference. Thank you, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.